Hyponatremia occurs when water intake exceeds its excretion.
This is a true medical emergency, and that's partly because of the collateral damage.
The etiology for this is almost classically hospital acquired.
What you really need to pay attention to is whether the patient has encephalopathy or not.
Make the call early. They're going to need to go to ICU.
Welcome back, everyone, to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. This is Mike Winters here from the University of Maryland School of Medicine, and I am so happy to be joined by my three co-hosts and colleagues, Dr. John Greenwood, Dr. Rob Rodriguez, and Dr. Peter W. Gentleman. How goes it this podcast?
Doing great.
Doing well, thank you.
Things are wonderful up here in Philadelphia, Mike. Thanks for asking.
Well, we are coming to the end of the summer here, certainly in the Northeast, and we are all anxiously awaiting the solar eclipse that's going to be happening in the next 24 hours, so we will certainly look towards that. This month, we are going to cover a very tough topic, a relatively simple topic in the sense of hyponatremia in the critically ill patient, but one that creates just an enormous amount of anxiety among practitioners of every level. Whether you're in training, our nursing staff, seasoned physicians, emergency and acute care providers, intensivists, we all get focused on hyponatremia, and I think that's primarily due to the risks of over-rapid correction. As luck would have it, in critical care medicine, EPUB Ahead of Print is a really great review article on the treatment of hyponatremic encephalopathy in the critically ill. Lead author was Archinger. And that article is really going to serve as the basis for this particular podcast on hyponatremia. But before we get started in the actual review of the article, the key discussion topics, John, is this something that you encounter frequently in your clinical practice?
Absolutely, Mike. This is something we encounter actually quite frequently. And just as you said, a number of people and specialty groups get really anxious about not just the patient, but the numbers that they're seeing when they get a phone call, especially our renal colleagues, about a patient with acute or chronic or presenting with hyponatremia. And in general, the number that we define for a patient who is hyponatremic is a sodium less than 135 milliequivalents per liter. And in general, when someone is hyponatremic, it reflects an overall hypoosmolar state, so more water than solute here. And it is frequently encountered both, I think, in the emergency department as well as up in the ICU. And I think the biggest or the most concerning symptom that is often presented are neurosymptoms, and that can be encephalopathy, being altered mental status, seizures, or neurologic deficits. But this is a true medical emergency, and that's partly because of the collateral damage that can happen with a truly low sodium. Fortunately, though, a lot of times the treatment is determined by the patient's presentation and clinical symptoms that they come in to the emergency department with. It really doesn't depend on how long they've been that way, for the most part, or the absolute decrease in serum sodium value. For the most part, when you walk into the room and walk out of the room, and then you get this lab value back, you can kind of get a sense of where you'd like to go with this patient.
Outstanding introduction there, John. And just to orient all of our listeners, what we're going to focus on this discussion is really that sick end of the spectrum with hyponatremia. Their clinical symptoms are, in fact, being produced by that significantly low sodium. So the patient with hyponatremic encephalopathy, neurologic symptoms, not really addressing the patient who comes in, you evaluate them, and on lab values, you see that they're hyponatremic, but normal mental status, non-focal exam, really no clinical symptoms. That's not the patient we're going to focus on this podcast. We are going to talk about what to do when someone demonstrates those neurologic symptoms, and it's due to profound reductions in serum sodium. Rob, without doing too much of a deep dive, why does this occur? Why do patients become hyponatremic?
Yeah, so if you think of the pathogenesis of hyponatremia in very simple terms, hyponatremia occurs when water intake exceeds its excretion. And this usually occurs in the setting of impaired free water excretion by the kidneys. And so we typically divide the conditions that are associated with kidneys' inability to excrete a dilute urine into three categories. And these are the well-known categories of hypovolemic hyponatremia, hypervolemic hyponatremia, and euvolemic hyponatremia. Under hypovolemic hyponatremia, there are renal causes, the most common being diuretic use, and less commonly RTAs, And then even less commonly, mineralocorticoid deficiency. And then there's this relatively rare syndrome of cerebral salt wasting. And then when you think about extra renal hypovolemic causes of hyponatremia, again, these are pretty common causes, and that would be vomiting and then taking excess free water, diarrhea with excess free water intake, and then pancreatitis with free water intake. Moving on to the hypervolemic causes of hyponatremia, those are the classic volume overload states of CHF, cirrhosis, and acute or chronic renal failure. Again, the heart, the liver, and the kidneys. And then finally, finishing up with the euvolemic causes of hyponatremia, there are all the SIADH type causes, the postoperative states that can do this. And there's an exercise-induced euvolemic hyponatremia in which you lose a lot of salt and water, but replace that more with free water. There have also been some case series of rage parties in which ecstasy has been associated with euvolemic hyponatremia. Then there are a couple of other causes, hypothyroidism and glucocorticoid deficiency as well. So again, there are primarily problems in terms of intake of too much free water with decreased excretion of free water. And so during these hyponatremic states, what happens in terms of the brain, what happens is there's an osmotic gradient that develops between the circulation in the brain, and that results in water movement into the brain and basically brain cellular swelling. As this increase in volume of the cells, increased pressure can occur, and then you wind up getting some shunting of CSF out of the brain because, of course, the skull's a set box. So something has to move. And ultimately, this capacity for adjustment is limited. There's a limit as to how much you can remove of CSF. And neurologic injury can occur as the brain swells further and you get high ICP and cerebral edema.
Thanks, Rob. Helps to clarify really what's going on in these patients, why they're developing neurologic symptoms and the overall cellular swelling with the limited capacity. Now, Peter, let's return to the bedside. So these patients come in, we're focusing on the really sick patient. What are the main clinical manifestations we're looking for?
Absolutely. So the most important understanding for all the listeners out there is that the actual absolute change in serum sodium is really a poor predictor of what the clinical symptoms are. And the way that we want everybody to think about it is the time process by which the patient became hyponatremic. And you would divide it into acute, an uncertain duration, and then chronic. By acute, we mean less than 48 hours. The etiology for this is almost classically hospital acquired. We made a poor choice as a clinician or an error with drips. This happens in the postoperative setting, and it most classically is associated with the use of hypotonic fluids. The second one that I mentioned after acute is really an uncertain duration. And in the emergency department, classically, these are the ones that we see because we really don't have a stopwatch or a time clock to determine how long this has been going on. So it really is most common for us because we don't have the historical data points. These are classically diuretic related, hypovolemia associated, the cases of SIADH, and adrenal insufficiency. Those are the most classic ones. We talked about acute, and we said uncertain. Now we're talking a dive into chronic. And so this is really greater than 48 hours. And the classic patients for this are the patients with recurrent episodes of congestive heart failure. And so other pearls to remember for this clinical manifestations are that patients with any type can develop encephalopathy associated with hyponatremia. The early signs that we see associated with this tend to be nausea, emesis, and associated headache complaints. As the intracranial pressure begins to rise, we then get to see altered mental status. You can delve into seizures. You can actually see respiratory failure, brain herniation, and then subsequent death. So those are the most common clinical manifestations.
Outstanding. Really, really helpful. So looking for nausea, vomiting, headache, and then really a quick downward spiral as ICP increases. Well, John, as we're focusing on the patient with hyponatremic encephalopathy, are there any patient risk factors that may clue us into this patient may be at increased risk moving towards this end of the spectrum of hyponatremia?
Yeah, Mike. So interestingly enough, there is. And the three key ones that this paper pointed out were gender, age, and the development of hypoxemia as primary risk factors shown to be a predictive of poor outcome rather than other rates of development of hyponatremia or other absolute values of sodium itself. And I think age makes sense. They note particularly less than 16 years of age. And again, going back to that kind of Monroe-Kelly hypothesis. So inside your skull, you can only fit blood, brain, and CSF. And in general, kids or younger adults' amount of cerebral tissue is a lot greater than the elderly. So any bit of swelling can make a significant impact, leading to encephalopathy or symptoms of cerebral edema. I remember I had one kid who was in his late teens who had been taking MDMA, and ecstasy in itself, which contains MDMA, it's kind of a setup for hyponatremia because I think it increases vasopressin secretion. In addition to, they're at these rave parties and they're just drinking water, water, water. Who came in and his sodium was on the lower side, was around in the high teens, one teens, but severely symptomatic. Whereas I've seen patients who are in their 60s, 70s with CHF who come in with sodiums of 120 talking to you, asking for something to eat. So age is definitely something that can predisposition someone to severe symptoms of hyponatremia. Now, females in particular, premenopausal age, are also at increased risk of periprocedural hyponatremia, and that's partly due to estrogen. Estrogen decreases some of the sodium, potassium, ATPase, preventing solute extrusion. So the kidneys handle sodium a little bit differently due to whether it's exogenous or endogenous estrogen. And there's also some impaired regulatory brain volume decrease that can happen in females. And again, diuretic use, exercise, and use of DDAVP, those medications might predisposition females to be higher risk for the development of hyponatremia compared to males. Now, I mentioned hypoxemia, and hypoxemia is kind of an interesting one, but that's also due to some sodium potassium pump abnormalities that can happen. But I think if you're thinking about edema altogether, if you're developing edema in multiple organs and having significant additional end organ dysfunction other than the brain edema, but also lung edema, hypoxemia is one of those that we all know in terms of neurocritical care no-nos we want to avoid at all costs. So hypoxemia on top of cerebral edema and decreased cerebral perfusion is going to end up being something that patients don't tolerate so well. So I think that adding to that any sort of just kind of the cerebral edema that goes along with it, any other insult, hypotension, hypoxemia are patients that you really want to be careful about who have significant hyponatremia.
Outstanding. So we've got a few clinical risk factors that should clue us in that this patient's at higher risk. We know the clinical manifestations of hyponatremic encephalopathy, things that we should be looking for as they go from mild encephalopathy with nausea, vomiting, headache, to the more severe end with seizures, respiratory failure, and possibly death. Let's get into actually treating the patient now at the bedside. So, Rob, let me turn to you specifically with the goals of treating this patient with hyponatremic encephalopathy. What are we really aiming to do?
So what you really need to pay attention to is whether the patient has encephalopathy or not, and not worry too much about how quickly that hyponatremia is developed. Your focus, again, should be on whether the patient is encephalopathic. And so what you really want to do is, if the patient is encephalopathic, you want to correct the hyponatremia. And the standard approach would be to use 3% hypertonic saline at approximately 2 mLs per kilo. And typically in a 50 kilo adult, this would be about 100 mLs of 3% saline. And this can be given as a bolus through a peripheral IV. And a single bolus of this 2 mLs per kilo of 3% hypertonic saline will result in a typical rise of about 2 MEQs per liter in serum sodium. It'll raise their serum sodium about 2 points, basically. And there really have not been any head-to-head studies evaluating bolus therapy versus continuous infusion. But for our purposes, it probably makes the most sense if the patient's encephalopathic to go ahead and give them that bolus. In most cases, of approximately 4 to 6 milliequivalent per liter rise in serum sodium will reverse the encephalopathy, reverse those neurologic symptoms. But if the patient does not get clinical improvement from that, then you got to start opening your box a little bit more. You got to start thinking about, well, maybe the hyponatremia is not the actual cause of the patient's symptoms. So again, these patients are typically complicated. They have a lot going on. So you really need to pay attention to that. If they do not improve with that 4 to 6 milliequivalent per liter rise in serum sodium, in general, you should not correct the serum sodium more than 5 milliequivalents per liter in the first 1 to 2 hours. And then final correction of sodium should not exceed more than 15 MEQs per liter in the first 48 hours. So again, bolus therapy of 3% saline, 2 mLs per kilo, and you should check the sodium every 1 to 2 hours after you do this. You should, of course, perform frequent neuro checks to see if the patient's encephalopathy or other neuro symptoms are improving. And you should also monitor urine output.
Outstanding. Peter and John, do you have any other nuances that you use or tips when you're treating the patient with encephalopathy or severe neurologic symptoms, specifically due to hyponatremia?
You know, one of the things that Rob mentioned that I just want to echo and really impress upon everybody, if we're going to use hypertonic saline in a bolus fashion, as this article recommends, we really, really have to monitor our sodiums closely. I get them hourly in these cases. I don't go to the 2 hour mark. I get them hourly if I'm doing bolus administration, because I really want to follow that very, very carefully, understanding that more than 5 milliequivalents in the initial 2 hours is a risky place to be.
Yeah, Mike. And I think one of the interesting points that Rob brought up too is final correction shouldn't exceed more than 15 milliequivalents in the first 48 hours. Even just during residency, I remember kind of rule of thumb that not to go more than 0.5 milliequivalents per liter per hour throughout the course of the patient's care, which is clearly a lot more. That would be 24 milliequivalents in 48 hours rather than 15. So for the encephalopathic patient, perhaps they're a little bit higher risk for complications. So as long as you get their symptoms under control, once you're in that kind of stable phase, moving a little more slowly might be more important. So I think that's an interesting point.
That's great, John. And getting back to something that you had mentioned, Peter, with the frequency of checking sodium, I think this is primarily one of the reasons, not only for monitoring, but the frequency of blood draws, that often, at least at Maryland, these patients don't go to a general floor bed. They're usually at a higher level because of increased nursing needs and increased needs for blood draws.
Absolutely.
One caveat or one issue that I'd like to bring up and get your opinions about is the patient who's seizing in hyponatremia. And, you know, that's always been a bit of a difficult patient to manage and to think about. I personally administer, again, 3% hypertonic saline with a similar type target. Of course, I'm also giving other agents to stop the seizure as well. It's always kind of a difficult one for me, because then after the seizure stops, you know, they're typically postictal, and you're kind of stuck trying to determine whether that's because of their postictal state or is it because of the hyponatremia. I don't know if you guys have had similar sort of conundrums or concerns about that patient.
So, Rob, I do as well. And then I'm also stuck thinking, are they having non-convulsive status? Because typically these patients with their altered mental status before we've even given them agents wind up intubated. So it makes it tough, real tough.
I think as part of the patient who comes in seizing, we're going down the seizure route with benzos, maybe levetiracetam, and other agents such as phenytoin and fosphenytoin. I don't typically include hypertonic saline in my initial treatment regimen for the undifferentiated seizing, actively seizing patient. So usually it's afterwards, but nonetheless, if there's a prior history and we have information on the patient, I do what you do, Rob, and if I think it's due to the hyponatremia, we give 3% hypertonic saline, and I use an approach similar to what the authors recommend in this article, and that's starting off with just 100 mLs of 3% and monitoring for the clinical effect.
I think it's also to remember you're treating this patient as essentially a neuro patient, right? So we're doing all the other things to decrease ICP. And first rule of thumb is aggressive and algo sedation after you intubate them. So starting them on fentanyl drip, propofol, that'll also decrease your ICP as you go along, as also you're treating the sodiums. And, you know, we're really fortunate here at Penn where we have on our VBGs, our point of care VBGs, we have sodiums on them, which are pretty accurate compared to the BMPs. So we'll just send off point of cares. We'll just do point of cares every hour or so rather than sending it to lab, which unfortunately here can take a little bit longer in terms of closer to an hour or so to get a result back. So if you have access to a point of care VBG with electrolytes on it, definitely use it for this type of patient.
Great discussion, guys. Well, Peter, let's wrap this up with our last section. We've kind of danced around it. We've mentioned osmotic demyelination syndrome. Who's at risk for the development of this complication?
So for this demyelination syndrome, it's really a complication of the overcorrection of the patients with the severe hyponatremia. This is one that we all talk about. It's primarily seen in those patients that have hyponatremia on the longer end of the spectrum, so greater than 48 hours. And they typically have plasma sodiums on the south side of 115 milliequivalent, so less than 115. It really doesn't appear to be related to an excessive hourly rate of correction, provided that the overall correction is less than 20 milliequivalents per liter. And again, you have to be worried about the time course that we do this in as well. The main risk is not from the use of hypertonic saline, but rather from the renal response to the fluid therapy and a spontaneous free water diuresis that occurs when the stimulus for vasopressin release abates. We get rid of that. So the risk factor, so who's at profound risk for this? Those that have thiazide-induced hyponatremia, those with water intoxication, we see a good bit of that in my shop, DDAVP-induced hyponatremia, and in those patients with severe liver disease. So those are our major risk factors for ODS. Also, we can think about some others that include hypokalemia, alcoholism, those patients who are malnourished, hypophosphatemia, and then the one that we mentioned before, the additive effects of hypoxemia. And so that makes us really cautious. Symptoms typically occur days to weeks following the correction of hyponatremia, so we really don't have our answer right away. And those symptoms can range from asymptomatic patients to extreme agitation, just really altered mental status. The diagnosis is made and confirmed with MRI. That's what's required.
Super helpful there, Peter, in terms of identifying the risk factors when we're treating patients with those specific conditions. Certainly paying much closer attention, not that we wouldn't in general, but as we're correcting someone who is encephalopathic, if it's due to one of these conditions, absolutely be thinking about the precipitation of osmotic demyelination syndrome. Well, guys, I think that's going to wrap it up for this hyponatremia discussion. This has been super helpful, from Rob talking about why this develops, the classifications once again. Peter, awesome job in terms of the clinical manifestations, what we need to be on the lookout for. John, identifying who is at true risk in the literature regarding hyponatremic encephalopathy, the severe form, and once again, younger age, females of premenopausal age, hypoxia, and those with brain injury. And then basically, how do we go about treating these patients using hypertonic saline, using it safely? What's an empiric approach when we've got someone who's encephalopathic from hyponatremia? And then we talked about the correction factors not exceeding certain values or threshold values. So any remaining points before we bring this podcast to a close, Peter?
Just that, again, for the initial 48 hours, don't go more than 15 milliequivalents total, and just be cautious with that aspect of it.
Rob?
Yeah, I'd say that my main message is don't be afraid of using hypertonic saline. It's not something that we're that accustomed to using in the ED, but if you do it, as we mentioned, in a controlled fashion and monitor your serum sodiums closely, it's the way to go. Just again, don't hesitate in using it.
John, bring us home.
I think there's a great summary. And the nice thing about hyponatremia is in general, the patients respond as predicted. And with some simple arithmetic, you can kind of figure out how the patient's going to respond. So listen, just bite the bullet. You know they're going to need lab tests every hour, almost like that DKA patient. So if that means from the emergency department standpoint, they have to go to a higher level of care, make the call early. They're going to need to go to ICU, get Q1 to 2 hour BMPs or sodium checks. So move the patient along, but get them started off in the right direction downstairs.
My thanks to gentlemen, of course, for another outstanding discussion. We will have all of these numbers in the handout, the risk factors, the clinical symptoms, the correction factors not to exceed. So please refer to our handout. We also will have a link to the article that is, once again, EPUB Ahead of Print in Critical Care Medicine with the lead author, Dr. Archinger. Gentlemen, thanks for a wonderful discussion, and we will talk to everyone next podcast.